In Santa Barbara, California, Stu could only stand and stare at what he was seeing. He had felt the same way 2 years earlier, when he had first set foot inside Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. That incredible achievement had been due to the efforts of countless laborers, toiling over hundreds of years. What he saw now, in all its simple elegance, was the product of a single, brilliant mind. The racks were open to the air, but not a speck of dust was visible anywhere. Everything was pristinely clean, but then, almost as an afterthought, Stu realized something else. The room was eerily silent. There may have been 800 high-end GPUs in the room, but not a single one of them was running.
"I turn them all off,"
Irene Hansen said, noiselessly materializing in the open doorway behind Stu and answering a question he had not yet asked.
"My son always paid his own electric bill," she continued. "After he died, when that first power bill showed up, it was so high I almost had a heart attack. I had my yard man come down and unplug everything."
Stu winced at that. He would have preferred to have each blade powered down individually to keep from corrupting the data. Then again, if Frigg had already dispersed all the files, maybe powering down properly wasn't that big of a deal.
"Owen never liked me much,"
Irene added as an afterthought, entering the soundless room and running her finger along the dust-free surface of one of the racks.
"He liked his machines better."
Still unable to speak, Stuart Ramey nodded in reply.
"He always blamed me for his father's death,"
Irene continued.
"Owen was convinced that it was my fault that his father committed suicide."
And then, without any warning, she flung herself at Stuart and fell weeping against his chest. Irene Hansen needed someone to lean on right then. It didn't matter to her that the person she chose for her leaning happened to be the one who had contributed the most to bringing her son's murderous crime spree to an end. No, that didn't bother her in the least. All his life, Stuart Ramey had recoiled from any kind of human contact. For a long time, he stood frozen with both hands raised in the air, as if they were strange appendages belonging to someone else, and he was uncertain about how to use them. At last, he lowered his arms. He wrapped them around Irene's tiny heaving shoulders and held her close. That was the first thing an astonished Cammy Lee saw when she entered the computer lab through the open slider. Stuart standing there holding a grieving Irene Hansen against his massive chest and gently rocking her back and forth.
"It was the most amazing thing," Cammy would tell Allie much later. "You just had to be there."
Chapter 22. Allie awakened thinking about that damned building inspector. She had been battling the building department off and on for weeks. Abby Henderson was a bureaucrat's bureaucrat whose best trick was putting people on hold and forgetting about them. What Allie still couldn't wrap her head around was the idea that less than 2 hours after Abby had insisted that the inspection couldn't be done until the middle of the following week, it had already been completed by a county employee working overtime on a Friday afternoon, none of which made any sense. In Allie's experience, the Yavapai County Building Department was an entity that not only under-promised, it also under-delivered. Something was out of sync here, and Allie couldn't quite put her finger on what it was. Still, if the inspection was out of the way, a little gratitude was probably in order. That was one of her mother's enduring lessons.
"It never hurts to say thank you," Edie Larson had always insisted, "even when you're dealing with annoying people. Sometimes, especially when you're dealing with annoying people."
Abby Henderson certainly qualified on that score. Leaving Bella asleep in the bed, Allie padded over to the love seat, opened her computer, and sent Abby Henderson a brief note. "Thanks for expediting our final inspection. I'm so happy to have that out of the way earlier than expected. We have equipment coming soon,
and it'll be great to be able to get it installed and working. With her self-assigned thank you note completed, Allie scanned through her mail, dumping the spam and checking for messages from B. She was relieved when there wasn't one. At the moment, he was probably in the air over the Atlantic, somewhere between England and Maine. Considering no news good news, Allie took her laptop with her, and with Bella scampering at her heels, headed to the kitchen in search of coffee. Before returning to the UK, Leland had given Alonso a crash course in the running of the Reynolds-Simpson household, including a computer file filled with extensive directions and suggestions, as well as a compendium of recipes. As a consequence, it was no surprise for her to find Alonso at the kitchen counter, putting the finishing touches on Bee's somewhat delayed welcome home meatloaf. As she made her way to the coffee pot, he looked up and nodded good morning.
"Your Saturday morning special for breakfast?" he asked. "Herbed scrambled eggs?"
"Yes, please," she said. "I'd like that." While Alonso set about making breakfast, Allie sat in the nook, reading her online newspapers. When an email announcement arrived, she switched over immediately, expecting it to be from B. It wasn't. The terse message came from Abby Henderson, who clearly wasn't overjoyed at receiving Allie's thank you note.
"Dear Miss Reynolds, I do not appreciate being contacted during my off hours except in cases of dire emergency. As I specified in our phone conversation yesterday afternoon, we are unable to complete the final inspection of your project until sometime next week, most likely not before Thursday or Friday at the earliest.
Once again, let me remind you that no equipment of any kind may be moved into the remodeled space until the open permits are cleared for occupancy.
If you have any further questions in this regard, please feel free to contact me during regularly scheduled working hours, Monday through Friday."
"That's weird," Allie said aloud, feeling a slight glitch in her stomach. Something that had seemed mildly strange before now was even more so.
"What's weird?" Alonso asked.
"Shirley Malone told me that the building inspector came by last night and cleared our permits, but I just now heard from the scheduler who says the inspection is still pending." Reaching for her phone, Allie dialed Shirley's home number.
"Sorry to bother you on a Saturday," Allie said when Shirley answered, "but tell me again about that building inspector."
"He stopped by about 4 and left right around 5.
"Why?"
"Because I just heard from Abby Henderson at the building department. She claims the inspection is still on the schedule for late next week."
"But he was there yesterday for sure," Shirley said. "I walked him back to the lab and he got right down to it."
"Did you stay with him while he was working?" Allie asked.
"No," Shirley answered. "I had to leave him alone so I could go back up to reception."
"What was his name again?"
"Barris," Shirley said at once. "Steve Barris. But he said most people called him Sonny. He was sort of flirty, but sort of smarmy, too, if you know what I mean. He was wearing a name badge with a photo ID. As he was leaving, he told me straight out that his inspection was complete and that we'd passed. I hope I didn't do anything wrong by letting him in."
"Did he bring anything into the building with him?" Allie asked.
"A toolbox and some tools, which he was none too careful with, by the way," Shirley told her. "Do you want me to drive over to the office and make sure things are okay? It's no trouble."
Allie was thinking about what else might have been in that toolbox besides tools. What if this was some kind of sabotage plot? What if one of High Noon's competitors had decided to take their corporate headquarters off the map with a toolbox full of C4? Or worse yet, with Stu and Cammy out of town, what if someone had infected their computer systems with some kind of self-replicating worm that could quickly spread to the computers of all their corporate clients? That would put them out of business every bit as quickly as detonating explosives.
"No," Allie said quickly.
If anyone needs to go check, I will. And don't worry about any of this. It's not your fault. It's probably some kind of misunderstanding. That's what she said.
But Allie wasn't at all sure it was true.
Next, she found Dave Holman's number and called. Dave was the chief homicide investigator for Yavapai County. He and Allie had been an item once, but the relationship had ended amicably. At the time, they had been at different stages in their lives. She had been done raising her son, while Dave was still dealing with parenting issues and relatively young children. Afterward, they had both married other people, but the friendship between them had endured.
"Morning," Dave said when he answered. "Long time no hear. What's up?"
Allie knew that as a member of the sheriff's department, Dave would have access to a comprehensive personnel directory containing the names of all county employees. "Are you at home or at work?"
"What do you think?" Dave replied. "It's the weekend. Working a domestic from last night. Right now it's only attempted murder. With any kind of luck, the victim will live and that won't change. But we have to do the whole investigation just in case. What can I do for you?"
"I'm curious about a county employee, a guy named Steve Barris who works for the building department."
"How do you spell that?" Dave asked.
"B-A-R-R-I-S. A clatter of keyboard keys clicked in the background.
"What's he done?"
"He came out to do an inspection for our remodel."
"He may have done your inspection," Dave said, "but there's nobody here on the county employee rolls by that name, although he could be a new hire who came on board after the directory was last updated, or maybe even a temp of some kind. Why, is there a problem?"
Allie felt another clutch in her gut. If Barris wasn't a county employee, who the hell was he? "I wanted to know if he was on the up and up," Allie said. "We were told the inspection wouldn't be done until next week, but he showed up and did it yesterday afternoon."
Dave laughed aloud at that. "Right," he said. "When bureaucracy works too fast, it's easy to be suspicious."
Dave's offhand dismissal didn't leave Allie feeling any better. "Probably just a misunderstanding on my part," Allie said, repeating the same line she had used earlier with Shirley. "Thanks for the help." She ended the call just as Alonso set a plate of chef-worthy scrambled eggs and buttered Dave's killer bread whole grain toast on the table in front of her.
"Is there a problem?" he asked.
Obviously, he'd been privy to her part of the conversation. "The guy who did the inspection? Maybe a phony," she said. "Shirley left him alone in the lab with all that equipment at a time when both Cammy and Stu were out of town, and that bothers me a lot. As soon as I finish breakfast and before I go pick up B, I'm going to run over to Cottonwood and take a look around. Although I don't know how much good that will do. I'm the last person at high noon who would be able to tell if someone had been messing around with our computers." Alonso gave her a quick look.
"I'd be glad to ride along," he suggested.
"I was already planning on going over there this morning anyway to do some shopping."
Allie appreciated his concern and knew it was not unfounded. Alonso's first day on the job hadn't exactly been uneventful. Alonso had been headed toward Cottonwood in order to complete the hiring process paperwork when he'd been pulled into an emergency situation that placed him behind the wheel of Allie's Cayenne during a hair-raising car chase up Mingus Mountain. That shared firefight experience had cemented their new employee-employer relationship in a way nothing else could have. And the supposedly temporary job offer had been amended to permanent on the spot. A younger Allie Reynolds might have rebuffed Alonso's offer of backup, but an older and wiser Allie did not. If something was amiss at the office, having a retired but still very able-bodied seaman along for the ride would be a good idea.
"Okay," she said,
"if you're sure you wouldn't mind."
"Not at all."
"Okay, then," Allie told him. "I'll go get dressed." She was in the bedroom pulling on a sweatshirt when B called.
"Hey," he said. "Hope I didn't wake you."
No, I'm up and getting dressed. Where are you?
On the ground in Bangor, refueling. They're slow as dial-up internet around here. I guess they're having way more traffic today than usual. By the time we get off the ground, Dan says we should be in Flagstaff by 4 or so. What are your plans for the morning?
Did she want to lay any of this building inspector mess on B when he was about to be stuck in a plane for 5 hours with no way to do anything about it but worry? But not telling him was wrong.
Alonso and I are about to make a quick trip to Cottonwood. He needs to pick up a few things, and I want to stop by the office. Yesterday afternoon, a somewhat shady individual bluffed his way past Shirley, claiming to be a building inspector.
Don't tell me she let him inside.
She did. With both Stu and Cammy out of town, I want to give High Noon a once-over to make sure everything is A-okay. Do you have any advice about what I should look for?
Have you heard anything from our traveling road crew? B asked.
Not so far this morning, she answered. They were supposed to pick up the truck in Burbank first thing. They're probably already in Santa Barbara by now. If not, they're bound to be close.
Call Stuart and ask him to run a scan. He can do that remotely. And don't worry, we're pretty bulletproof.
Allie felt the weight lift from her shoulders. Thank you, she said.
Okay, B added after a moment. Dan is saying it's time to load up. See you in a few.
Half an hour later, Allie and Alonso headed for Cottonwood with him behind the wheel and her seated in the passenger seat with Bella, who had begged to go along curled up in her lap. On the 30-minute drive, Allie brought Alonso up to speed on why Stu and Cammy had gone racing off to California. After all, since Alonso had been in on all the action the day of Owen Hansen's suicide, it was only fair that he know what was really going on. Once they reached the office, they left Bella in the car while Allie used keypads to raise the security shutters, unlock the front entrance, and turn off the alarm. Inside the building, she went straight to the visitor's log on the reception counter and checked the entry for the building inspector. Steve Barris, whoever he was, had clocked in at 4:10 and out at 5:03. With Alonso on her heels, Allie did a quick walkthrough of the building. Nothing was apparently out of place, and everything seemed to be in good order. Equipment that was supposed to be on was on, and equipment that was supposed to be off, including the collection of darkened monitors over Stu's and Cammy's workstations, was clearly off. Finished with her cursory inspection, Allie had turned and started out of the room when her phone rang.
"Is something wrong?" Stu demanded when Allie came on the line. "What are you doing in the office on a Saturday?"
Allie pulled the phone away from her ear and looked at the screen. This was definitely not a FaceTime call.
"How do you know I'm at the office?"
"Motion-activated cameras," Stu answered. "The one stationed behind Shirley's desk is the one that sent me the first alert. When I'm there, I don't keep the notification function turned on. But since Cammy and I were both going to be out of town, I switched it on while we were on our way to the airport."
"Wait," Allie said. "We have surveillance cameras in here? Really?"
She paused long enough to glance around the room and saw no sign of a camera setup. For a moment, she was angered by the idea of being under surveillance, but then curiosity got the better of her.
"I never noticed them. Where are they?"
"That's the whole point with surveillance cameras," Stu said. "You aren't supposed to notice them. They're supposed to be subtle and invisible, but wherever there's a bookshelf in the office, you can count on there being at least one working camera. Most of the books really are books, but some of them aren't. For instance, the camera that's filming you right now is on the bookshelf next to my wall of monitors."
Allie stepped closer to examine the shelf. As far as she could see, the shelf contained nothing but a row of thick equipment manuals.
"I don't see any camera," she said.
"Exactly," Stu said. "You're seeing books, and that's what most of them are. But the one in the middle of the top shelf isn't what it seems. If you look closely, you'll see that the inside pages have been removed to leave space for the camera."
On closer examination, Allie spotted a camera lens peering out through the lettering on the spine. She was so relieved that she almost burst out laughing.
"I'll be damned," she exclaimed. "I never would have noticed that in a million years."
"That's the idea," Stu explained, sounding more than a little proud of himself. "I bought the cameras and figured out how to place them inside the book covers. Cammy was responsible for the artwork. The camera over Shirley's desk is situated in what looks like an office supply catalog."
"What about my office?" she asked. "Is that under surveillance too?"
"St. Thomas Aquinas," Stu answered. "Volume 1 is in your office, and Volume 2 is in B's. I didn't think you'd miss them."
When Allie had first signed on to work with B at High Noon, her first assignment had been to spruce up the premises and get rid of the motley collection of mismatched furniture that made the place look like the leavings from an abandoned consignment store. She'd repainted walls, had new carpeting installed, and replaced worn-out desks and chairs with first-rate office furniture. Then, hoping to give their offices a bit of class and some additional gravitas, she'd added one final detail. After the death of Allie's second husband, Paul Grayson, all his worldly goods, including his extensive wine collection and the contents of his showy library, had come to her. She and Bea had started making inroads on the wine collection almost immediately, but at the time she had embarked on decorating the offices at High Noon, the books had still been languishing in boxes in a storage unit uptown. Allie had donated most of them to a Friends of the Library sale, but she had been unable to force herself to let go of some of them. The upscale, leather-bound editions of the great books that had once been included in the purchase price of some long-since-discarded set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Allie had brought the books out of forced retirement, freed them from their boxes, and then used them as finishing touches for her office space makeover. She had divided the books into two sets and lined them up on spanking new shelving units, half in Bea's office and half in hers. Only now did she discover that two of the books had been cannibalized to hold the surveillance video cameras.
"I think you're right." That time Allie really did laugh aloud. "I don't think I'll be reading either of those tomes anytime soon." "You still haven't told me why you're in the office on Saturday morning," Stu said again. Allie may not have known about the interior surveillance system prior to this, but she was relieved to know about it now. Whoever Mr. Barris was, Stuart would most likely have him on camera, doing whatever it was he'd been doing.
"I was actually going to call you about that. B wanted me to ask you to run a security scan."
"How come? Have we had an intrusion?"
"Maybe," Allie said. "A county building inspector who was supposed to show up sometime late next week dropped by late yesterday afternoon instead, just as Shirley was getting ready to leave. The whole thing seemed off to me, but as long as you've got him on video, I'll stop worrying. Maybe you could take a look at what you've got and see if he was doing anything out of line."
"I'm a little busy right now," Stu told her. "Lance and his guys just showed up. I can start the scans right away, but checking the video feeds takes time. I'll take a look at them when I have a chance and get back to you. Do you know about what time he was there?"
"Between 4 and 5, Allie told him.
"Okay," Stu said. "I'll check it out. I've got to go."
Chapter 23. On Saturday morning, Graciela cut through the crime scene tape, stepped into what had been her mother's room, surveyed the minefield awaiting her there, and immediately called down to the manager's office, asking for help. Half an hour later, a motley group of 4 young men arrived at her door. They came armed with a rolling grocery cart and plastic trash bins, along with an assortment of cardboard boxes. The guys were willing workers. With Graciela doing the sorting through the clutter, they carted away load after load of accumulated junk. When they finally cleared away the debris surrounding the bed, Graciela had them drag that away next,
watching with what she realized was a curious lack of emotion, as her mother's actual deathbed was dismantled and lugged out of the room. One of the workers asked would she mind if he took the headboard and frame, and Graciela told him it was fine. As for the bedding, mattress, and box springs, those were all destined for the dumpster at the back of the building, although she had a sneaking suspicion that her work crew would cart some of those away as well, turning those, along with her mother's many other dubious treasures, into someone else's. As the clutter disappeared, some of the original furnishings emerged. A chest of drawers, a dressing table, a love seat, along with a door to a closet that had been invisible for years. Hanging in the closet, Graciela found some of the glamorous clothing that had come into the house from the storage unit all those years ago. Some of them, slinky cocktail dresses and floor-length evening gowns, were things she dimly remembered seeing her mother wearing. Christina had been so beautiful back then. In Graciela's eyes, her mother could have been a movie star or a princess. Just because Graciela remembered some of the outfits didn't mean she kept them. The dresses went into the discard boxes, as did the shoes. She sorted through the drawers, emptying them all and consigning the contents to the trash bins before sending the dresser and chest of drawers away as well. There was nothing of her mother's that was worth saving. If Graciela's helpers happened to notice her lack of sentimentality concerning such things, they were too happy making off with Christina's usable furniture, including the flat-screen TV from the living room, to make any mention of Graciela's state of mind. As the day drew to a close, and with her mother's room completely empty, Graciela made one last check of the closet. At the very back of an overhead shelf, she discovered a thin box. Her first thought, as she brought it down, was that it might contain a strand of long-forgotten pearls. When she opened it, however, she discovered inside a series of articles and or obituaries written in English and printed on pieces of brittle, age-yellowed newsprint, all of them concerning Christina's assault. Graciela shuffled through the stack, glancing at the stories. One of the six perpetrators had committed suicide. Two had died of drug overdoses, one in L.A. and the other in Dallas, Texas. One of them had been the victim of a hit-and-run in Fresno, California. Two had been shot to death in what was believed to be gang-related violence, one in Chicago and the other in Detroit. Those two homicides remained unsolved. The last article in the stack was one written in Spanish and taken from a local paper called Panama Hoy, Panama Today, detailing the court-martial convictions of the six airmen involved in the savage rape of Christina Miramar. All had been found guilty and dishonorably discharged. The local prosecutor, who could have charged them with rape as civilians as well, had declined to do so. They all went home to the States with what was widely regarded by locals as nothing more than a slap on the wrist. Going back to the obituaries and matching the names with the ones charged in the attack on Christina, Graciela immediately suspected she was seeing El Pescado's handiwork. The six men who had attacked Christina had gotten away with it as far as any real justice was concerned, so her father had followed them home to the States, systematically tracked them down, and exacted his own style of revenge. Late in the afternoon, Graciela retreated to the living room with a damning box of articles, unsure what she should keep or toss. If those papers ever surfaced in the wrong hands, they would irretrievably link her to El Pescado. Still curious about the details, she sat in the living room and using her laptop and secure dark web-based server, she tracked down all available information on the men involved. The six deaths had taken place over a 3-year period of time, in the early 90s in far-flung towns from one end of the U.S. to the other. Some of her searches led her back to those original obituaries. An article about one of the unsolved homicides actually referred to the court-martial proceedings resulting from the attack on Christina Miramar several years earlier. Did learning about her father's mission of revenge give Graciela any comfort? Hardly. Just because he had punished the attackers didn't give him a free pass, nor did the fact that he had looked after both Christina and Graciela during all those intervening years. His actions after the fact didn't absolve him of his original crime, the unforgivable betrayal of abandoning them in the first place. There were no strands labeled forgiveness located anywhere in the Duarte family's DNA, and in that regard, Graciela truly was her father's daughter. When Graciela had satisfied herself that she had learned all there was to learn about the deaths of the six men who had attacked her mother, she took the stack of yellowed articles into the kitchen. She placed them in the sink, lit a match, reduced them to ash, and washed that down the drain. When she was done, she showered the grime off her body, then left the apartment and hurried down the street to the little family restaurant on the corner of Via Brasil.
Los de siempre?
The woman behind the counter greeted her with a smile.
The usual?
The usual was sancocho, the thick, stew-like chicken soup that is Panama's traditional cure for a hangover. Since Christina had been drunk on a daily basis, she had practically lived on the stuff, and Graciela had always ordered carry-out containers of it from here rather than going to the trouble of making it herself. She nodded.
Sí, por favor.
The woman frowned.
But I thought your mother...
She bit her lip and fell silent.
Yes,
Graciela said with a sad smile, graciously acknowledging the expression of sympathy from this near stranger, just as a properly grieving daughter ought to do.
You're right. My mother is gone now, and the sancocho was her favorite. But I have been thinking about her today, and it seems only right to order it tonight.
Of course, the woman agreed. It's important to keep our lost loved ones with us, by remembering the foods they liked.
Will there be anything else?
No gracias, Graciela told her.
Solo a sancocho.
Chapter 24. There was no way Stu could have anticipated how easily the complex job of packing up Owen Hansen's handiwork could be accomplished. Every piece of the network had been laid out with exacting attention to detail. Stu and Lance began the project by numbering each of the racks so that when it was time to put them back together, they could mirror the original arrangement in every detail. Each cord and each connection was numbered and labeled to allow for easy reassembly once the equipment arrived in Arizona. Lance was as impressed by the elegance of Owen Hansen's setup as Stu was, and the two tech guys talked as they worked. Lance was excited about the idea of adding Frigg to High Noon's cyber arsenal. Stu was far more wary. He was still on what he called the one-and-done page. Turn Frigg on, get the passwords, turn her off, and get the hell out. From the way Owen Hansen was able to penetrate other people's devices with impunity, Stu said, Frigg must be loaded with all kinds of electronic eavesdropping crap that shouldn't be there. No doubt a lot of it is absolutely illegal. If Hansen had been caught using it, he might have ended up in jail. You can bet that if we're caught using any of it, we really will go to jail. We'll also be out of business. Maybe we can get Frigg to do a self-scan and give us a directory of the programs that cross the line so we can delete them. From what I've read, some of those deep learning algorithms are machine-readable only and are indecipherable for humans. What's to stop Frigg from dispersing that collection of illicit files out into the ether again so she can retrieve them whenever she wants, just like she did last time? Stu asked.
You'd better figure out how to keep that from happening, Lance said.
And you need to do it now, before you let Frigg back online.
Tell me about it, Stu said miserably.
I can't get the passwords without putting her online first.
Sounds like you're screwed then, Lance told him with a grin. But at least you'll have the money.
A mere 6 hours after they started the project, it was done. While Stu and Lance had been deconstructing all the connections, Lance's crew of muscle men, directed by Cammy, had removed all the monitors from their brackets, wrapped them in protective film,
and loaded them into the truck. Once the racks had been disconnected from their wall mounts, they, too, were wrapped in packing film, hauled outside, and strapped securely into the truck. At last, the only piece of equipment remaining in the space was the antique Macintosh sitting in solitary splendor on the library table. Stu punched the power switch, and the screen came to life. It was password protected, so Stu couldn't run it, but that didn't stop him from taking the top off to look inside. With the lid off, the machine wasn't at all what it appeared. It may have looked old, decrepit, and out of date, but under the hood, Owen Hansen had installed a powerful collection of some of the very latest computer wizardry. Cammy came back inside through the sliding door just as Stu was replacing the outside cover panel. "You're not taking that piece of junk along with us, are you?" she asked.
"I don't think it's junk," he told her. "I suspect this old goat of a computer functioned as Owen Hansen's base of operations."
"That was my husband's," Irene Hansen said, nodding toward Stu and the Mac. Once again, and despite still wearing those stiletto heels, she had turned up behind them as silently as a ghost.
"They gave it to Harold for free because it was one of the first computers off the assembly line. They used Harold's chip, you see. He was a very smart man. And so was his son. Owen barely knew his father, and yet they were very much alike."
Stu took a deep breath. He hadn't told Irene Hansen everything he needed to tell her earlier. Now he cleared his throat to do so.
"Your son left me some money," he said.
That wasn't exactly the truth, but he didn't want to bring Frigg's machinations into the discussion.
"More than just some," he added. "The money is on deposit in some offshore accounts. Once I get the passwords and pay whatever taxes are due, I'll return anything that is left over to you."
"Oh, don't do that, sweetie," Irene said.
"I already have all the money I'll ever need. If Owen gave it to you, he must have meant for you to have it."
Stuart Ramey was stunned. It wasn't just that Irene had passed on his giving her any of Owen's money. That in itself was almost incomprehensible. She had just called him sweetie, however, and that was something that had never happened to him before in his whole life.
Chapter 25. Walking back home with her takeout soup in hand, Graciela examined the neighborhood. The apartment building on Calle 61 Este was called El Sueño, the dream. The whole time Graciela had lived there with her mother, she had dreamed of living elsewhere. She had watched longingly as sparkling new high-rises had sprouted throughout the city. Those were the kinds of places where several of her very important clients maintained penthouse suites. She had always imagined that once her mother was no longer in the picture, she'd move into one of those, preferably in one of the top-floor units, and take her rightful place in the universe. But the last few days had caused her to rethink her place in the universe. As her father's primary money launderer, she knew exactly how much money was floating around inside El Pescado's illegal world. She knew which numbered accounts belonged to him and which ones belonged to each of her half-brothers. While sorting out the trash in her mother's room, it had occurred to her that maybe there already was enough money. Maybe she didn't need any more. What she should probably do was to consolidate what already existed by collapsing the cartel and walking away with the remaining spoils. She wasn't yet sure how she'd go about accomplishing that goal, but she intended to bring El Pescado's cartel down in the time-honored Duarte fashion, by turning brother against brother and father against son. Graciela, an unassuming and unmarried spinster in her mid-30s, wasn't anyone's idea of a drug lord. She wasn't the least bit glamorous or even especially good-looking. She lived a quiet and ostensibly sober life. No one looking at someone who had selflessly cared for her mother for years would consider her capable of turning on her family and destroying them from within. Her father and her brothers would be wary of attacks coming from outside, from rival cartels or from the cops, but not from her. Her challenge was to point the authorities in the direction of El Pescado and his sons without being drawn into the fray herself. There would be plenty of time later on for her to live a flashy life. Right now, she needed the protection of the same kind of invisibility that had served her so well as a vagrant child, wandering on her own and begging for money in the slums of Panama City. Now she would be an invisible drug cartel kingpin, hiding in plain sight in a run-down, somewhat seedy condo complex. She doubted anyone other than her father would know to come to El Sueño looking for her, and by the time he did, it would be too late. Back in the apartment, Graciela was about to dish up her soup when the phone rang. The name in the caller ID belonged to one of Graciela's co-workers. Isabel Flores' cubicle was next to Graciela's. She was also the assistant office manager. "Have you heard?" Isabel asked breathlessly. "Heard what?" Graciela asked, feigning innocence, although she was quite sure she already knew the answer.
"It's about Arturo," Isabel said. "He never made it home last night."
"Really?" Graciela replied. "What happened?"
"You knew he left the office with Bianca yesterday, right?"
"I was pretty busy yesterday," Graciela said. "I guess I didn't notice. Why?"
"The cops came by here a little while ago. They got my name from Arturo's wife. They told me that they found Arturo's car early this morning. It was stuck in a ditch outside of town. The car was shot full of holes and covered in blood, but there was no sign of Arturo."
Right, Graciela thought. She had told her contractor to get rid of the body, and he had.
"Anyway," Isabel continued, "the cops found the valet receipt in the car and traced it back to the hotel."
Graciela didn't bother asking which hotel, because everyone in the office knew the one Arturo preferred above all others.
"They showed me a clip of security video from the valet stand out front. It showed Arturo plain as day. They wanted to know if I recognized the woman who was with him."
"And you told them it was Bianca?"
"Of course. What else could I do? They left here to go talk to her. They'll probably take her in for questioning. They might even arrest her."
"You don't think she could have anything to do with this, do you?" Isabel asked.
"She always seemed so..."
"Naive, maybe?" Graciela put in.
"Exactly," Isabel agreed. "Naive and innocent."
"Looks can be deceiving," Graciela said with an inward smile. "Just because Bianca looks innocent doesn't mean she is innocent. Maybe she has a boyfriend or a brother who took exception to Arturo's behavior. It's about time somebody did." Once off the phone with Isabel and feeling quite happy with herself, Graciela dished up her soup and then brought her laptop to the table to keep her company while she ate. When she logged into the dark web storage site, there was still no video link, but she was pleased to find several audio files queued up and waiting. With a real sense of satisfaction, she hit the play button, ready to listen in on the conversations of the people who were unwittingly broadcasting every word from close to 6,400 kilometers away. Graciela had hoped that the first voice she heard would be Stuart Ramey's. She needed to gain some insight into who he was and how he operated, in hopes of figuring out how to handle him once they were in touch. Unfortunately, the only voice audible on the recording belonged to a woman. Allie Reynolds, maybe? Since no other voices were part of the conversation, she was most likely speaking on a telephone. Graciela heard the recorded voice say something about surveillance cameras. Unable to make it out, she ran the recording back and played it again.
"Wait, we have surveillance cameras in here? Really? I never noticed them. Where are they?"
A knot formed in the pit of Graciela's stomach. Hadn't Robbie forwarded a message from Ron Webster claiming that there hadn't been any interior surveillance inside High Noon? Hadn't he told her that he'd gotten away clean? If there were cameras at work, that wasn't true.
Graciela returned to listening in time to hear the woman say,
I don't see any camera.
A short time later, the woman in Cottonwood exclaimed,
I'll be damned! I never would have noticed that in a million years.
That exchange led Graciela to conclude that there had to be at least one camera present inside High Noon Enterprises, very probably more than one. If there were interior surveillance cameras, it was only a matter of time before her planted listening devices would be found, and the whole exercise would be a total waste of time and money. She had been assured that Ron was a smooth operator. Obviously, that wasn't true. Not only had he not been smart enough to spot the surveillance, he had also failed to hook up the video link, and had subsequently lied about it. It didn't take long for Graciela's shock to turn to anger, and eventually to rage. She had no intention of tolerating that kind of bungling. If the cops took Ron into custody, how long before he gave up Robbie? And if that happened, how long before they showed up on Pablo's doorstep, since she had used her half-brother's account to pay the bill? For a long time after the audio file finished playing, Graciela sat there waiting to see if there would be another. Allie Reynolds had obviously left the building shortly after the recording ended. Finally, with no additional files available, a frustrated Graciela left the storage site and logged into a different one. These days, when El Pescado required the services of a paid killer, he often turned to a group of assassins affiliated with MS-13, who filled that bill in any number of locations, both inside the U.S. and elsewhere. When Graciela set up the hit on Ron Webster, she was more than happy to pay extra for expedited service. Once again, and just for consistency's sake, she paid good money out of Pablo's account for overnight delivery. She'd been led to believe that Ron Webster was subtle and smart. Obviously, he was neither. And that was why, although he was too stupid to realize it yet, he was on his way out. As for Graciela's long-distance new hires, they were known to be thorough, lethal, and not the least bit subtle. Clearly, the authorities in the U.S. weren't especially interested in solving crimes committed in the distant past, so she would offer up some Duarte cartel-related crimes that were a bit more current. She would use the cops to bring her father down, along with her two half-brothers. Once they were gone, with any kind of luck, she, Frigg, and Stuart Ramey would be the only ones left standing. Chapter 26. A few minutes past 3, Cammy and Stu waved goodbye to Lance and his buddies and drove away from Irene Hansen's mansion on Via Vistosa. As Allie had specified, Cammy was at the wheel of the rental truck while an emotionally drained Stu sat slumped in the passenger seat. They were on Highway 101 and headed south when a text came in from Allie. Did you ever have a chance to check those surveillance feeds?
Crap, Stu said aloud.
What's wrong? Cammy wanted to know.
Allie asked me hours ago to check the interior surveillance feeds, but I got so caught up in the dismantling project that I forgot to do it.
Do it now, Cammy said. Hauling out his laptop, Stu did exactly that. Since the cameras only functioned when there was movement, once he was logged in, it took no time at all to locate the images. He quickly scrolled through the segments where he had picked up Allie's and Alonso's presence earlier that morning. The previous series of segments featured the two-person cleaning crew who had come in and vacuumed, dusted, and emptied the trash shortly after 9 on Friday night. The timestamp on that footage indicated that the cleaners entered the building at 9:02 and locked up at 10:10. The file just prior to that one showed Shirley letting herself out through the front door. Then the shutters closed, leaving the screen in darkness with a timestamp of 5:07. At that juncture, Stu skipped back several segments until he found one with a timestamp of 3:56. Shirley had evidently been away from her desk. Filming resumed when she returned to the reception area. For a time, the feed showed her in profile. The movement of her fingers as she typed something into her keyboard was enough action to maintain the video feed. Then, at 4:03, she looked away from the screen toward the door, where a male figure wearing a hat was now visible through the clear glass. A moment later, Shirley reached toward the intercom button. There was no audio component with the system. As a consequence, Stu was unable to make out any of the verbal exchange that followed. Eventually, however, the door opened and the man entered the building, removing his hat as he did so. When Stu and Cammy had created the system, they had opted for high-resolution cameras with far more pixel capability than that found in most CCTV systems. So when the newcomer paused directly in front of the reception area to sign the visitor log, Stu froze the feed long enough to enlarge the image and send one screenshot to Allie and another to himself. When Stu studied the photo, the man wasn't someone Stu recognized. When he returned to the feed, he discovered that shortly after signing the visitor in, Shirley moved out from behind the counter to lead him to the lab. There were no bookshelves in the hallway, and hence no cameras either. The next segment of footage showed Shirley and the newcomer arriving in the computer lab. Stu watched while the man set down a small toolbox and a clipboard. Again, there were some inaudible verbal exchanges before Shirley left the room, presumably to return to reception. Sure enough, a second feed soon appeared showing her back at her computer. Meanwhile, in the first one, the visitor opened his toolbox, retrieved a screwdriver, and then removed something else. A small box of some kind, maybe? Since this was a building inspector, Stu expected him to go straight to the newly installed electrical panel, the one the electrician claimed was tough enough to power 300 toasters at a time. Instead, and without giving the panel so much as a passing glance, the man disappeared into the new lab space, where once again, with no bookshelves or books available, there was also no camera coverage. When the feed resumed again, the visitor came into view and approached the toolbox briefly before once again going out of frame. At no time in any of the footage did he go anywhere near the electrical panel he was supposedly there to inspect. In fact, the next segment showed him messing with something inside the light switch next to Cammy's desk and directly behind Stu's.
"Why, that S.O.B.," Stu exclaimed.
"What?" Cammy demanded. "What's going on?"
"I think he's bugging the place."
"Bugging?" Cammy repeated. "Are you kidding?"
"Not at all.
I think he's installing listening devices and or cameras throughout the building."
"No way!"
"Way," Stu replied. "And if that guy's a building inspector, I'm a monkey's uncle."
A moment or two passed before Stu spoke again, his voice trembling with outrage. "He just went into my apartment. What the hell? If I ever lay hands on the guy, I'm going to wring his damn neck." Sure enough, the next feed showed the intruder in the main living area of Stu's studio apartment, this time messing with the cover plate on the light switch next to the front door, where he worked for several minutes before shaking his head. Evidently, something had gone wrong. He returned to the toolbox once again before reappearing inside the apartment and finishing whatever he'd been trying to do. The next-to-last clip, filmed by the camera located over Cammy's workstation, showed the guy drop to his hands and knees and crawl under Stu's desk until only the soles of his shoes were visible. Shirley's arrival in the frame caused him to emerge from under the desk in such a hurry that it looked as though he had creamed his head on the desk drawer. As Shirley neared the toolbox, he hurriedly reached over and closed the lid, only to have to reopen it a moment later to slide the screwdriver inside. The next clip, back in the reception area, showed the so-called inspector signing the visitor's log and exiting the building. A few minutes later, Shirley finished gathering up her things before she, too, left the building, closing the shutters behind her. By the time Stu's screen went dark, he was on the phone to Allie, with the speaker turned on so Cammy would be part of the conversation.
"We've got a problem," he announced. Is B there?
We both are, Allie replied. You sound upset. What kind of problem are we talking about?
Where are you?
At the house and about to sit down for dinner. Where are you?
We're locked and loaded in the truck, out of Santa Barbara and headed home. But turn on your speaker. I want to talk to both of you. We've had an intrusion, and I think we may have been hacked.
Hacked? B demanded.
Did your scan show up something?
I don't think he touched the computers, Stu answered. But someone sure as hell got inside and was messing around in our building.
Who are we talking about? B asked.
That so-called building inspector Allie was worried about was totally bogus. He wasn't there to sign off on our permits. I believe he was using the inspection gig as a cover so he could install some kind of electronic surveillance system inside our offices.
You're sure he didn't access any of our computers? B asked.
He didn't go anywhere near the computers. At least not that I saw, Stu answered.
He was mostly messing with cover plates for some of the light switches and electrical sockets.
He was probably tapping into the wiring, B suggested. That way he'd have access to a steady power supply with no need for batteries.
Exactly, Stu said. Without batteries, he can use equipment that's small and difficult to detect.
My gut instinct says we're probably dealing with audio only, since some of the locations have limited sight lines. But they're positioned in such a way, I doubt they'd ever be spotted by a real building inspector.
What a nightmare, B declared.
My sentiments exactly, Stu agreed.
Okay, B said urgently. Allie and I should probably head for Cottonwood right now. Find out what's been planted there and get rid of it.
There's no point, Stu said.
No point, B objected. What do you mean?
If whoever installed the bugs has been monitoring our feeds, they most likely heard everything that was said earlier this morning when Allie and Alonso were there. That means they know we had cameras running and that we're most likely aware of their presence.
You're saying we just leave the bugs in place?
For right now, Stu replied. Whoever's behind this can monitor the hell out of us, but as long as no one's in the office, they're not going to learn anything useful. In the meantime, give me a while to go to work and try to figure out who's behind this.
How do you propose to do that?
I'd rather not say, Stu answered.
I take it we're talking about one of your backdoor operations? B asked.
Stu said nothing, which as it turned out, they all understood to mean yes.
And how long a while are you talking about? B asked.
Long enough for us to get home, Stu said.
As I said, Cammy and I are on the move right now. If we drive straight through, the GPS says we should arrive sometime after 1 a.m.
He looked over at Cammy, who had both hands on the wheel and her eyes on the road.
Are you good to go? He asked.
As in all the way home?
Yes.
You bet, Cammy said. As long as you ply me with enough coffee.
Wait, Allie said, breaking in on the conversation.
You two are talking about driving straight through even after doing the loadout? That's nuts.
It's not nuts because this is an emergency, Stu replied, brushing aside her objection. High Noon is under siege, and we need to get to the bottom of it. From what I saw on the tapes, Shirley interrupted the installation. The guy didn't get any further than my apartment and the two computer labs. Just to be on the safe side, though, any talking we do at the office should be done outside the building rather than inside.
No one has tried to spy on us before, Allie said. At least not as far as we know. So why would something like this happen now? What's changed?
I'm about to reactivate Frigg, Stu said quietly. What do you want to bet that's what's changed?
The AI, Allie breathed. Is someone after the AI?
An incredibly smart AI, Stu replied.
They all took a moment to digest that.
So who all knows about that? B asked.
The four of us and Lance, Stu answered at once.
And Alonso, Allie added.
I told him about it this morning. What about the guys who helped?